This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 3, Part 5. Our relations with foreign courts had been put on the most economical footing. The only diplomatic agent who had the title of ambassador resided at Constantinople, and was partly supported by the Turkish company. Even at the court of Versailles, England had only an envoy, and she had not even an envoy at the Spanish, Swedish, and Danish courts. The whole expense under this head cannot, in the last year of the reign of Charles II, have much exceeded £20,000. In this frugality there was nothing laudable. Charles was, as usual, niggardly in the wrong place, and munificent in the wrong place. The public service was starved that courtiers might be pampered. The expense of the navy, of the ordnance, of pensions to needy old officers, of missions to foreign courts, must seem small indeed to the present generation. But the personal favourites of the sovereign, his ministers, and the creatures of those ministers, were gorged with public money. Their salaries and pensions, when compared with the incomes of the nobility, the gentry, the commercial and professional men of that age, will appear enormous. The greatest estates in the kingdom then very little exceeded 20,000 a year. The Duke of Ormond had 22,000 a year. The Duke of Buckingham, before his extravagance had impaired his great property, had 19,600 a year. George Monk, Duke of Albemarle, who had been rewarded for his eminent service with immense grants of crown land, and who had been notorious both for covetousness and for parsimony, left 15,000 a year of real estate and £60,000 in money, which probably yielded 7%. These three dukes were supposed to be three of the very richest subjects in England. The Archbishop of Canterbury can hardly have had 5,000 a year. The average income of a temporal peer was estimated by the best informed persons at about 3,000 a year. The average income of a baronet at 900 a year. The average income of a member of the House of Commons at less than 800 a year. 1,000 a year was thought a large revenue for a barrister. 2,000 a year was harder to be made in the Court of King's Bench, except by the Crown lawyers. It is evident, therefore, that an official man would have been well paid if he had received a fourth or fifth part of what would now be an adequate stipend. In fact, however, the stipends of the higher class of official men were as large as at present, and not seldom larger. The Lord Treasurer, for example, had 8,000 a year, and when the Treasury was in commission, the junior lords had 1,600 a year each. The paymaster of the forces had a poundage, amounting in time of peace to about 5,000 a year. On all the money which passed through his hands, the groom of the stole had 5,000 a year, the commissioners of the customs 1,200 a year each, the lords of the bedchamber 1,000 a year each. The regular salary, however, was the smallest part of the gains of an official man at that age. From the noblemen who held the white staff and the great seal, down to the humblest tide-waiter and gauger, what would now be called gross corruption was practised without disguise and without reproach. Titles, places, commissions, pardons were daily sold in market, overt by the great dignitaries of the realm, and every clerk in every department imitated to the best of his power the evil example. During the last century, no Prime Minister, however powerful, has become rich in office, and several Prime Ministers have impaired their private fortune in sustaining their public character. In the 17th century, a statesman who was at the head of affairs might easily, and without giving scandal, accumulate in no long time an estate amply sufficient to support a dukedom. It is probable that the income of the Prime Minister, during his tenure of power, far exceeded that of any other subject. The place of Lord Lieutenant of Ireland was popularly reported to be worth £40,000 a year. The gains of the Chancellor Clarendon of Arlington, of Lauderdale, and of Danby were certainly enormous. The sumptuous palace to which the populace of London gave the name of Dunkirk Mouse, the stately pavilions, the fish ponds, the deer park, and the orangery of Euston, the more than Italian luxury of Ham, with its busts, fountains, and aviaries, were among the many signs which indicated what was the shortest road to boundless wealth. This is the true explanation of the unscrupulous violence with which the statesmen of that day struggled for office, the tenacity with which, in spite of vexations, humiliations, and dangers, they clung to it, and of the scandalous compliances to which they stooped in order to retain it. Even in our own age, formidable as is the power of opinion, and high as is the standard of integrity, there would be great risks of a lamentable change in the character of our public men, if the place of First Lord of the Treasury or Secretary of State were worth £100,000 a year. Happy for our country, the emoluments of the highest class of functionaries have not only not grown in proportion to the general growth of our opulence, but have positively diminished. The fact that the sum raised in England by taxation has, in a time not exceeding two long lives, been multiplied 40-fold, is strange, and may at first sight seem appalling. But those who are alarmed by the increase of the public burdens may perhaps be reassured when they have considered the increase of the public resources. In the year 1685, the value of the produce of the soil far exceeded the value of all the other fruits of human industry. Yet, agriculture was in what would now be considered as a very rude and imperfect state. The arable land and pasture land were not supposed by the best political arithmeticians of that age to amount to much more than half the area of the kingdom. The remainder was believed to consist of moor, forest, and fen. These computations are strongly confirmed by the road books and maps of the 17th century. From those books and maps, it is clear that many routes which now pass through an endless succession of orchards, cornfields, hayfields, and beanfields, then ran through nothing but heath, swamp, and warren. In the drawings of English landscapes, made in that age for the Grand Duke Cosmo, scarce a hedgerow is to be seen, and numerous tracts, now rich with cultivation, appear as bare as Salisbury Plain. At Enfield, hardly out of sight of the smoke of the capital, was a region of 5 and 20 miles in circumference, which contained only 3 houses, and scarcely any enclosed fields. Deer as free as in an American forest wandered there by thousands. It is to be remarked that wild animals of large size were then far more numerous than at present. The last wild boars, indeed, which had been preserved for the royal diversion, and had been allowed to ravage the cultivated land with their tusks, had been slaughtered by the exasperated rustics during the license of the Civil War. The last wolf that has roamed our island had been slain in Scotland a short time before the close of the reign of Charles II. But many breeds, now extinct or rare, both of quadrupeds and birds, were still common. The fox, whose life is now in many counties held almost as sacred as that of a human being, was then considered as a mere nuisance. Oliver St. John told the Long Parliament that Strafford was to be regarded not as a stag or a hare to whom some law was to be given, but as a fox who was to be snared by any means and knocked on the head without pity. This illustration would be by no means a happy one if addressed to country gentlemen of our time, but in St. John's day there were not seldom great massacres of foxes to which the peasantry thronged, with all the dogs that could be mustered. Traps were set, nets were spread, no quarter was given, and to shoot a female with cub was considered as a feat which merited the warmest gratitude of the neighbourhood. The red deer were then as common in Gloucestershire and Hampshire as they now are among the Grampian Hills. On one occasion, Queen Anne, travelling to Portsmouth, saw a herd of no less than 500. The wild bull with his white mane was still to be found wandering in a few of the southern forests. The badger made his dark and tortuous hole on the other side of every hill, where the copsewood grew thick. The wild cats were frequently heard by the night wailing round the lodges of the rangers of Whittlebury and Needwood. The yellow-breasted martin was still pursued in Cranbourne Chase for his fur, reputed inferior only to that of the sable. Fen eagles, measuring more than 9 feet between the extremities of the wings, preyed on fish along the coast of Norfolk. On all the downs, from the British Channel to Yorkshire, huge bustards strayed in troops of 50 or 60, and were often hunted with greyhounds. The marshes of Cambridgeshire and Lincolnshire were covered during some months of every year by immense clouds of cranes. Some of these races the progress of cultivation has extirpated. Of others, the numbers are so much diminished that men crowd to gaze at a specimen as at a Bengal tiger or a polar bear. The progress of this great change can nowhere be more clearly traced than in the statute book. The number of enclosure acts passed since King George II came to the throne exceeds 4,000. The area enclosed under the authority of those acts exceeds, on a moderate calculation, 10,000 square miles. How many square miles, which were formerly uncultivated or ill-cultivated, have during the same period been fenced and carefully tilled by the proprietors, without any application to the legislature, can only be conjectured. But it seems highly probable that a fourth part of England has been, in the course of little more than a century, turned from a wild into a garden. End of part 5.